There's so much to look forward to in 2026 on the ABC. Yes.
Phenomenal.
Just you wait.
With new drama, Goolagong.
She's a natural.
Brand new dog park.
It's a shame we can't be more like them, isn't it?
I'm happy with a handshake.
A new take on a 90s classic.
Welcome to Race Around the World.
And new seasons of old favourites, like Austin, The Piano.
Give me more of that.
Grand Designs Transformations and Muster Dogs.
This brings things into focus, doesn't it?
This is fabulous.
So much to look forward to.
That's 2026.
It's a spectacular time.
On ABC TV and ABC iView.
From Wurundjeri country, I'm Lexi Junawick, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, the uprising in Iran grows more deadly as Donald Trump discusses military options and vows help is on its way. You'll hear expert analysis on what could come next.
So he has sort of laid the ground. He now has to deliver. Obviously, you know, this is a very complex situation.
Then later in the show, Adelaide's Writers' Week cancelled after a widespread author revolt. We'll examine the crisis at the heart of one of Australia's biggest arts events.
I can absolutely understand the massive amount of internal and external heat that has been generated as a result of this decision.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Help is on its way. That was the message to Iranians from US President Donald Trump on his Truth Social platform overnight, amid reports the death toll from nationwide protests in Iran has passed 2,000 people. It's the latest warning from the White House that the US could intervene militarily in response to Iran's deadly crackdown on protesters. Earlier, Iran reportedly proposed negotiating with the US, warning against the use of force and threatening America and Israel with retaliatory action. For more on this, host Jade McMillan spoke with Alex Vitanka. He's a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington.
What do you make of this messaging from the US president that help is on its way and that demonstrators should keep protesting?
I think it's a pretty significant statement because he's really now set out the stage and people expect both in Iran and his supporters in the United States that do want to see American involvement in this in terms of helping the protesters in Iran. So he has sort of laid the ground. He now has to deliver. Obviously, you know, this is a very complex situation. We now have almost fifth day into an internet blackout in Iran. So in terms of the information that the Trump administration needs to figure out what is best to do to help the protesters. I suspect that requires some time, but at a very minimum, what the president has done is he's kind of come out and very loudly said, I'm different from previous American presidents who watched, I'm going to intervene. But now the heavy lifting kind of has to be done, which is what kind of intervention? Because here he has to balance, on the one hand, helping these protesters, because the best case scenario is that the regime is toppled by its own people without the United States having to get involved in anything that is significant, because if that happens politically, that starts putting pressure on Trump back home here with his supporters, who by and large don't want to see U.S. involved in any more Middle Eastern and, for that matter, foreign interventions.
Donald Trump's national security team has been meeting to discuss options. What do you think could be among those options? What could be on the table if the president did decide to intervene militarily?
Look, I think they need time to think about it. But that said, the United States and Iran have been at loggerheads for about half a century. So all sorts of scenarios have been planned out of years. They have to revisit some old plans they've crafted in the past. But obviously, the situation today is unique. The president already kind of announced yesterday with the tariffs on any country that trades with Iran at 25%. That's more symbolic than anything else. People are looking at, ways that the U.S. can help the Iranians in Iran stay connected to the outside world. That's key, because it's so much harder for the regime and the elements that are still with the regime to sort of convince themselves that this is a way that they should stay the course. Because, you know, as you saw in the president's statements, take down names. Who's doing the killing? Soon enough, one day you have to answer for your crime. So obviously he's trying to shape the calculations of those people inside the regime saying you might just have enough time to get off this sinking ship, but it is sinking. And that's important. Last thing I say is, you know, a lot of folks talking about military intervention. That, to me, is the last, probably the last thing the U.S. would do, other than very kind of specific targeting in terms of the IRGC, that's the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, or the security forces that are known to be engaged in actual killing. You take them out by using the U.S. Air Force, and we know the Iranian air defenses are nowhere these days, so you have your choice. You can go and take them out. That would be seen as welcoming, I guess, by the protesters. And it wouldn't necessarily result in a backlash. In other words, you're not going to create some kind of a nationalist sentiment in the country because you're essentially targeting people that are killing fellow Iranians. So those are the types of things he needs to kind of look at. And last thing before I forget, the cyber aspect. I mean, U.S. has offensive cyber capabilities that can slow down the repressive machinery of the regime and make it harder for them to communicate as they go out there in the streets looking for protesters to target and to kill. So lots of things before we get to, you know, dropping bombs over the heads of the supporters of Ayatollah Khamenei. One of the things U.S. needs to do here is to think creatively. We want to avoid past mistakes in recent decades in other places like Iraq in 2003. United States needs to go out there and make a very clear point to those people who are still inside this regime, but who do not have blood on their hands, that they could get a way out of this if they stop supporting this regime now. Because we know ideology of this regime stopped appealing to even its supporters long time ago. A lot of people are in the system because that's where the paycheck comes in. You give them a reason to change that cost-benefit analysis in their minds. And again, you start shaking the foundations of the Islamic Republic from within. And then you don't need any types of really foreign intervention.
Some U.S. officials have reportedly raised concerns that if the president does authorize action here, it could fuel the regime's accusations that the U.S. is orchestrating these protests. Is that a risk, do you think, if the U.S. does get involved?
The simple reality is the United States, others like Israel, clearly have a vested interest here. They do want to see this regime go. If it becomes weaker, that's a net gain for the U.S., for Israel. But I don't fundamentally think we can put the protest movement and what's happening in Iran at the door of Washington or Jerusalem, for that matter. This is the doing of one man and his regime, Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, who's been there since 1989. And people shouldn't forget that. For 37 years, this man has refused to listen to his own people by essentially, you know, pursuing this militant Islamist worldview that vast majority of Iranians long time ago gave up on, if they ever did believe in it. So that's where the core problem is. It's that disconnect between a small ruling elite that essentially live in the past. I mean, again, reminding everyone, Ali Khamenei is 86 years old, and he's been in power for 37 years. And he's responsible more than Donald Trump, more than Bibi Netanyahu, more than anybody else for why Iran is where it is today.
Alex Vitanka, Senior Fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Back home now. The federal government's proposed hate speech laws appear to have already had an impact before they've even passed Parliament, with neo-Nazi group the National Socialist Network announcing it will disband by the end of the week. Debate on the omnibus bill to strengthen gun controls and hate speech restrictions will begin in Parliament next week, with some in the coalition signalling opposition to parts of the legislation. Josh Burns is the Labor MP for McNamara and a member of Melbourne's Jewish community. Jade spoke with him.
What do you make of this announcement from the National Socialist Network? Will it actually put a stop to their activities, do you think?
The first piece of reform that we did, if you cast your mind back, was actually we banned the Nazi symbols and the Nazi salute, and then several people have been arrested and charged with those offences, and you know, we have restricted the promotion of that hate-filled symbol and hate-filled action, but clearly the organisation of that group that you mentioned, the National Socialist Network, was unacceptable. I mean, these buffoons would get dressed in black and go and protest and walk down the streets and try and intimidate people, or they'd do it in the middle of the night, and were recruiting people and training and doing all sorts of things that were promoting their hate-filled ideology. And if the legislation announcement that we have brought has meant that they are disbanding and that is the end of their activity, well, that is a fundamentally good thing. However, we will also make sure that their track record of promoting hate and promoting their hate-filled ideology is continued to be monitored. And I don't trust their public statements for one second, so we'll have to make sure that the members of those organisations aren't continuing to promote or recruit or have any of their activity in any other form as well.
What's your assessment of this new legislation that is being put to Parliament next week? Is it an adequate enough response to the terrorist attack at Bondi, in your view?
The response to Bondi has been significant across a number of different policy areas, but there's also things that we don't know, which is why we've set up a Royal Commission into anti-Semitism as well. So this is, this is a long-term effort by the government and by authorities and institutions to ensure that people can just go about their lives and live safely for who they are. I do think that there are significant reforms that we have put forward that we will be hopefully passing through the Parliament that clearly are already having an impact, but it is not the only thing. And the work that David Gonski is doing to help ensure that better education and understanding of the Jewish community and anti-Semitism is included in the curriculum, as well as the work that the Special Envoy is doing to ensure that institutions actually better understand different forms of anti-Semitism and are able to adequately deal with it.
We have heard some criticism from the opposition about the decision to wrap these two issues of hate speech and gun control together in the one bill. Was that the right decision? Is there a risk that it could make it a lot more difficult to pass this legislation?
Well, the Liberal Party has been strong in press conferences. It's now time for them to be strong in the Parliament. I mean, they've been very critical of the responses around allowing hate and allowing anti-Semitism to occur in Australia. And I myself have said that, we haven't done enough and there is more that we need to do, clearly, in the wake of Bondi. Well, now there is something tangible that clearly has already had an impact and will have an impact. And I understand that the Liberal Party has had an airing of views inside the party and clearly also in the public, and that's fine. That's their business. But what they actually need to do is come to the Parliament and help us pass these laws. We can't do it by ourselves as a Labor Party. We need to work across the Parliament. And for everyone who's made a speech or everyone who's sought to say that the government hasn't done enough, well, those words will be very hollow if the Liberal Party doesn't come in and support us in ensuring that not only the hate that motivated the act of Bondi is confronted and outlawed and penalties are increased, but also the methodology of ensuring that people who shouldn't be carrying guns are not allowed to and that the firearms are banned. We have a strong history of gun prohibitions in this country, of ensuring that guns are not falling into the wrong hands, and it is absolutely critical that the Liberal Party support us in our efforts to have stronger protections against both hate and gun laws in next week.
The Adelaide Writers' Week has been cancelled following days of controversy over the decision to disinvite Palestinian-Australian author Randa Abdel Fattah. What's your view on the decision to cut her from the program?
This whole festival has been messy enough, and I don't particularly want to add to the messiness. I think part of it is the justifications that the Adelaide Writers' Festival have used, that they weren't connected to the concerns of what she'd said previously. So, I have previously had raised concerns about some of the material that she had used in the context of the university inquiry into anti-Semitism around calling for Israel's destruction and calling for there to be no culturally safe spaces for people, for Zionists, and for putting up social media posts that were glorifying paratroopers who went into Israel and committed a terrorist attack. So I think that those things are, real concerns. But the Adelaide Writers' Festival in and of itself was, they seem to have mishandled this whole situation. And as I said, it was messy. And I don't think having anything more to add to the specifics of the Adelaide Writers' Festival is particularly helpful.
So despite your concerns about her previous posts, you don't think she should have been disinvited? Am I interpreting that correctly?
I'm not quite sure what the motivation was to have her on the program in the first place, but still, that's a matter for the Adelaide Writers' Festival organisers, and clearly basically the whole board's resigned, and it's a very messy situation, and I'm not particularly interested in adding to that.
Josh Burns, Labor MP for McNamara. Adelaide Writers' Week has been cancelled and the Adelaide Festival Board has departed following the resignation yesterday of Writers' Week director Louise Adler. The decision to disinvite Palestinian-Australian writer Runda Abdul Fattah and the subsequent boycott of dozens of other writers is now threatening the future of one of the country's most important artistic events. Greg Mackey is an arts practitioner, former City of Adelaide councillor and founder of the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. Jade began this interview by asking for his thoughts on what has been a very dramatic 24 hours of developments in this story.
How are you feeling this morning about where this has all ended up?
I'm feeling most firstly for the writers who with the cancellation of the festival of Writers' Week, have lost their platform to connect with readers and to connect with each other. Adelaide Writers' Week for 65 years has been one of the, well, certainly the nation's and one of the world's great writers' festivals, once upon a time called a literary festival, but perhaps now in its own way more a festival of, as much a festival of ideas as it is of literature. I understand the decision taken by management of the Adelaide Festival Corporation to pull the plug this year, given the heat in the room. I completely support Louise Adler's principled position, and having been around Adelaide Festival and Adelaide Writers' Week throughout the 1990s and onwards, with a connection to the Festival Corporation through the Adelaide Festival of Ideas, I can absolutely understand the massive amount of internal and external heat that has been generated as a result of this decision.
Do you think that Runda Abdul Fattah should have been disinvited from Writers' Week?
I think that was a decision taken too late, a knee-jerk reaction, and in all probability out of, in part, a genuine desire to play ball, given the Premier's expressed views, which, whilst legally stopping short of direction, are in fact in South Australia, the Premier is the most powerful and influential person in public life and in political life. It is therefore understandable, I think, ill-judged, but understandable that the former, now former board took the knee-jerk decision that they did, but it was the wrong decision.
I believe the government has now announced a replacement board. Is that enough to keep the festival more broadly on track following the collapse of Writers' Week, do you think?
I do believe so. I know all of the four people who have so far been announced, and I believe there will be more announcements in the very near future. The interim chair, Judy Potter, who spent 9 years as chair of the Adelaide Festival Corporation, the immediate past chair, is a very, very experienced cultural governance practitioner and expert, and Rob Brookman, as the eminent scribe of the arts in South Australia, as the former artistic director of the Adelaide Festival, former chief executive of the Adelaide Festival, state theatre company, and the list goes on, is a very, very well-respected cultural leader who will connect with artists and arts companies, not only here but around the world, in relation to the program that we are still looking forward to enjoying presented in Adelaide in March.
In her opinion piece announcing her resignation as Writers' Week director, Louise Adler argued that boards made up of people with little experience in the arts had been unnerved, in her words, by political pressure. You've spent a lot of time involved in the arts world. What's your view on that argument?
I think that's a very sound observation on Louise Adler's part. The lack of practical arts sector, arts industry experience around the board was a very glaring shortcoming, I think, of the, with no disrespect to the individuals, but a very glaring shortcoming of what is a politically appointed board.
Has significant reputational damage been caused here? Do you think that the festival can recover from that?
with an eye to history, that this is not the first rodeo in terms of cultural and artistic tension and a public response and a political response. The brand for the Adelaide Festival is incredibly strong, and the goodwill nationally and internationally toward the Adelaide Festival is amazingly strong. I hope out of this recent drama, a future board will have a more careful regard to the role and function of a writers' festival as a mixing pot of ideas, a place for civil and civilised debate, a place where ideas can be shared and tempered and tested. And that is what the hundreds of thousands of people who flock to Adelaide Writers' Week every year have come to appreciate.
Greg Mackey, former City of Adelaide councillor and founder of the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. I'm going to take you to Queensland now, where Premier David Crisafulli has described flood damage in the central Queensland town of Claremont as heartbreaking. Up to 60 properties have been impacted after the region was hit with more than 200 millimetres of rain over 24 hours as ex-tropical cyclone Koji moved west. Meanwhile, in the northwest Queensland shire of McKinlay, farmers are slowly regaining access to their paddocks as lingering floodwaters finally recede. Janine Fegan is the Mayor of McKinlay Shire Council. Jade spoke with her.
Describe for me the impact that these floods have had on your community.
Oh, it's pretty significant and pretty horrendous for a lot of primary producers, graziers, the community. You know, we went through this in 2019 and they said it was one in 100 or one in 500. I can't remember what they said now, but a lot of people were not expecting this. So to turn around and have to pick up again in the space of about 6 years is pretty disappointing and heart-wrenching for them.
What kind of damage have people been dealing with?
The main damage is the stock loss, you know, obviously fences, troughs, tanks, you know, that's a big impact as well. But, you know, we have a wet season every year and most property owners are prepared for that, you know, and then local businesses with road closures for extended period of time, you know, there's loss of business, there's the concern moving into the future of, you know, will our graziers be able to support the community because, you know, if they're sort of having to pick up the pieces again. So I'm going to say, yeah, that the loss of the livestock has probably been the biggest impact.
And what's the situation at the moment? Are the floodwaters receding now and what is the weather forecast looking like?
Yes, they have receded. We've had blue skies for about a week or 4 or 5 days now, so that's helped dry the country out a little bit. Waters have receded, but there's still a long way to go because a lot of these cattle were stuck in mud and they're still, you know, with black soil. It takes a long, long time for that to dry up. And so in that meantime, you know, cattle are weak. They're trying to walk through heavy soil. Some are perishing because where they were on dry land and where the waters have receded, but then they've got to try and get to the water now. So they're sort of the considerations that we all have to put in place. So it's going to be a long recovery process. And I think the other factor to know is that we're just in the start of our wet season, you know, there's still February and March. So there's that probably that anxiety of what's going to happen in the future. So, but I must say most people, the sunshine and being able to get around has lifted people's spirits, and especially the state and federal government's commitment to assisting really gives you that hope to say, right, I can keep going because there will be a future, hopefully, that we, you know, we can get some cattle back in the place.
There has been some criticism of the flood gauges that are used in this area. Some graziers say multiple northwest Queensland gauges failed during the floods, which made it harder to save their cattle. What's your understanding of that situation?
Yeah, so as a council, we've always been involved with this process, and there is quite big dollars from the federal government through the BOM to look at the gauges and cameras. And I think it's now time for action to actually make sure that this all gets sorted out, because even as a local council, not having cameras on the right road made it difficult for us to plan which rivers were going, you know, which were rising, which were falling, where can we get stock in, you know, we were getting low on hay, we were getting low on avgas. And if you have that knowledge and you're not having to send council staff out, you know, to look at a rise and a fall, which could, you know, a creek could be 26 kilometres away, but in between there's little gullies that they couldn't cross. So having that knowledge and that insight does help for everyone, you know, and obviously the graziers knowing what's coming. So they can go to bed at night and think, okay, the river's only that high. I've got at least, you know, 2 days before this is coming through. Whereas when you don't know, you get more anxious, you don't sleep, you know, you're just there waiting till it happens.
So how do you think that problem needs to be addressed? Whose responsibility is it?
Oh, I think it's a combination, you know. I think, you know, as local councils talking to the state and the federal policy advisors and decision makers, but I think it needs to start at the ground, and I'm very keen to see a working group in our McKinlay Shire that will then go into our Northwest Rock, which is all the shires, you know, that we sort of our neighbouring shires that get together for the regional organisation of councils. But start at the basics and say to each of these property owners, okay, there was engaged there. Was that suitable or should it have had a camera? Get them on the ground to say, what have we got? What do we need? You know, the best solutions. But you can't be making a decision in Brisbane or Canberra as to where to put rain gauges, in my opinion.
Janine Fegan, Mayor of McKinlay Shire Council. And you can stay across latest warnings for your area by tuning into your local ABC radio station. Well, that's about all we've got time for on The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview was presented by Jade McMillan and produced by the Radio National Breakfast Team. The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Michael Kermond. I'm Lexi Junowick. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll be back with The Wrap the same time tomorrow.